This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Tatum, just get in the car.
Hello, Sydney.
Hi. Who is this?
You tell me.
Well, I have no idea.
Scary night, isn't it? With the murders and all, it's like right out of a horror movie or something.
Randy, you gave yourself away. Are you calling from work? Because Tatum's on her way over.
Do you like scary movies, Sydney?
I like that thing you're doing with your voice, Randy. It's sexy.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, come on. You know I don't watch that shit.
Why not? Too scared?
No, it's just, what's the point? They're all the same. Some stupid killer stalking some big-breasted girl who can't act, who's always running up the stairs when she should be going out the front door. It's insulting.
Are you alone in the house?
Randy, that's so unoriginal. I'm disappointed in you.
Maybe that's because I'm not Randy.
So, who are you?
The question isn't, who am I? The question is, where am I?
So where are you?
Your front porch.
Well, that's how the Scream phenomenon started. Scream and its popular sequel, Scream 2, which just came out on video, are horror films that also satirize the cliches of the genre. It's a winning combination, judging from the film's box office success. The director of both films, Wes Craven, has created, subverted, and lampooned the rules of the horror genre. He's made his name directing horror films such as A Nightmare on Elm Street, Vampire in Brooklyn, The Hills Have Eyes, and Last House on the Left. Last winter, when Scream 2 was in theaters, we called Wes Craven and asked him why he thinks the hybrid of horror and satire works so well.
I think that the fact was that horror had reached one of its sort of classical, cyclical stages of ennui on the part of the audience. You know, it just had gone so far along the same lines that people were bored with it and kind of knew what to expect, and It kind of was in that place where it needed to be satirized, at least before you went on and did something new. You have sort of acknowledged, this is where we've been, I know you're all bored, and I know you're thinking you know what's going to happen. So that became kind of the charm of it. In that sense, it's kind of a release, you know. It's like a joke about anything. There's kind of a rush of relief that it's being talked about, very frankly, you know. So, in the sense that you say, we know horror films have been either boring or stupid or predictable, there's kind of a rush of relief because they know, well, at least they're in the presence of somebody who is smart enough to figure that much out. Now let's see if they can do something new.
Now tell me what you found most predictable. Your characters have some opinions on that. what's your opinions?
Well, you could quote some of the characters. You know, the big-breasted girl who runs upstairs instead of out the front door when there's a threat, and always goes to investigate and sort of does the stupid thing rather than the smart thing. The classic situation of the girl running away from the monster and always falling down. You know, there's all those cliches in horror films that, we wanted to avoid and also acknowledge or stand on their head. So I think it was a large part of that, just the sort of stupidity, sort of a built-in sexism quite often, a sense of gore for gore's sake, and also a very heavy emphasis on this sort of killer at the expense of any characterization of the more normal people, if you will. And also a complete lack of recognition of the fact that these were events that were happening within the context of a society that had movies about these subjects. You know, people in the movies of this sort had never commented on the fact that they were in a situation very similar to movies that we all know and could easily talk about.
Right, and that they could use that knowledge to help them.
Exactly.
In the press kit for Scream 2, one of the producers is quoted as saying that she is awed by your ability to evoke terror from the actors you work with. She says, he can make an actor so terrified that you actually believe these things were happening to that person. What is she referring to?
Well, I don't know exactly. You'd have to ask her. I mean, you know, part of the job is to get that sense of the reality of situations when actors and actresses are surrounded by crew and cameras and not much is really happening, you know, in the actual physical space they're in. You know, try to remind them of things that they might have filmed 3 weeks before in a, you know, totally different environment that will cut immediately either to or from the moment they're in now. So you kind of, you know, you're kind of their ally in putting them into context of that sort of ephemeral thing, which is the movie that's going to be but is not right at the moment. You know, that's to me one of the biggest tricks of directing is just trying to make them see the movie that isn't done yet, or, you know, has hardly begun.
Because they're just seeing the moment that they're shooting right now, and you want them to see what happened just before and what's about to happen.
Right, and what's happened to the character, and you know, what it means personally, and you know, what might have frightened her 10 minutes before in the movie that the actress might have completely forgotten about. I mean, and it's sometimes just, you know, in conversations with the actor or actress, for instance, a specific example would be working with Drew Barrymore when she first came on the location. She and I stayed up late one night and just talked about our lives, and from that I learned a lot of personal things. Her extreme connection to animals, for instance, that I was able to use. So quite often when she was reacting to things that in the script were, like, say, somebody breaking a window and trying to get at her, it was she and I were talking about what was happening to a puppy in a news article about somebody who had tortured a dog. You know, so there's all sorts of tricks. You just try to find the sort of, you know, the commensurate place in their subconscious, in their real life, and connect it to the imaginary events in a way that's meaningful to them, and it's different for every single actor and actress.
Hmm. Wes Craven is my guest. I mean, in the opening of Scream 2, Jada Pinkett and Omar Epps play two people who are going to the movies, they're on a date, and they're going to see a horror film called Stab. And Stab is the film version of the murders that had taken place in their town. And actually, these were the murders depicted in Scream 1. Uh-huh. And Jada Pinkett is at this horror film very reluctantly. I mean, she doesn't like horror films. She thinks they're kind of racist, too, because if there's an African-American in it, they're going to get killed off right away. But, you know, she doesn't like these horror films. And everything that's happening in the theater is really her worst nightmare. The teenagers are dressed in the masks that the killer wears in the movie. They've obviously seen the movie like dozens of times, and they're back again, and they're kind of chanting and race, and, you know, there's a lot of bloodlust in the theater.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if you've ever seen strange reactions to your films, reactions that you might have not been very comfortable with, where the audience is getting more into the bloodlust than in identifying with the killer than the victim.
Right. I'd be a liar if I said I had not been in that situation, because I have, and when I have, it's been very disturbing, and certainly that scene was designed to reflect that, you know. To the extent it sort of says to the audience, to the extent that you're enjoying somebody suffering and dying on screen, you are out of touch with reality. And obviously that whole scene is, you know, designed to juxtapose a screen death with an actual death within the theater, and the shock of the audience when they finally realize that what they thought was a big publicity joke was an actual murder. So there is a condemnation of that reaction to that kind of film at that moment, and I think it's quite shocking. And it was a wake-up call in a way. The entire film has that theme running throughout it, the theme of, do these films encourage, cause, or, you know, such behavior, or do they, if nothing else, sort of trivialize suffering?
I know when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, horror film meant usually a supernatural film, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman. You're one of the people who made the horror film more about teen anxieties and, you know, slashers who prey on teenagers. Sometimes those slashers are fellow teenagers. Sometimes they're more supernatural kind of figures, you know, like Freddy Krueger. Tell me a little bit about how you think the meaning of horror films became transformed.
Well, I think they're quite profound films. You know, they are dealing with fear, which is certainly one of the primal emotions, and one of the most immediate signals of danger and the necessity for taking action or else not surviving, you know. So you can't get much more basic than that. And they always sort of perceive, you know, what is sort of that subcutaneous, subconscious fear that's in the culture at the time. You know, there were lots of films in the 50s about, you know, the effects of atomic energy.
Mm-hmm.
There were early on films, I think, even at the dawning of science about, you know, the effects of science on human conduct, for instance, like Frankenstein, you know, where you have, it's all based on what can be done medically, you know, to this person, and how that is either in control or not in control. And there was a long period of sort of psychosis as, you know, sort of the key element of fear, because it seemed like there were so many things that had happened in society. I think even post-World War II, where you had culture coming out of the sort of, you know, coming out of shock of what they had just seen of an entire world at war and these sort of horrendous events being perpetrated by, you know, by the Nazis and in a sense by everybody that, you know, went to war against each other.
So Psycho would be a good example of that.
Psycho was a great example of that, and I wanted to mention that, you know, because that is a pure case of not a monster in the sense of a, you know, Godzilla or something, but it's a human monster. I think, you know, horror films like Godzilla and King Kong are kind of a relief in a way because they are so removed from our reality. They're a little bit more of a popular entertainment, although I think in some ways that they speak also to a sort of a subconscious dread that we have botched nature so much or offended it so much that it's going to come back and get us.
My guest is Wes Craven. He directed Scream, Scream 2, and A Nightmare on Elm Street. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with horror film director Wes Craven. His films include Scream and Scream 2. Now, I know you didn't see many movies as a kid. I think your parents were very religious.
Right.
And what were their fears about movies?
Well, I think that as much as I can put it together, because it was never expressed so much as it just was a fait accompli when, you know, we just didn't go to movies, was that they were just too worldly, using that term that is used in that fundamentalist world, and that basically I think meant they were too sexual and too... I think probably the sexuality of it more than anything else was what disturbed them. But, you know, the fact of the themes and the subjects were too risque, too sexual, too whatever for to be of any good to the mind and body, which was considered the tabernacle of the Holy Spirit. So, you know, there was kind of a panoply of things that were not done or allowed. You know, smoking, drinking, playing cards, dancing, all of those things were forbidden. So it simply were not part of my life, and it wasn't a huge problem for me. I mean, I, you know, if you're not aware of something, it's simply not there in a way. And
Where did you grow up? I mean, and how
Cleveland, Ohio. It's, you know, it's, it wasn't like I was living out in the middle of in a holy roller territory. It was just a fundamentalist Baptist church, and my mother was very, very involved in the church, and the church was virtually the core of our social life. You know, we went all day Sundays and Wednesdays for prayer meetings and church camps and church daily vacation Bible schools and everything else. It was my world until I broke out of it. So,
do you feel that any of your horror films have addressed your innermost fears?
No, I think they all have. You know, I think there's a great deal in there that that has to do with that. And you know, I know that Freddy Krueger. And this is not to be, you know, this is the sort of thing that one's mother in Cleveland can hear by third hand and be horrified by. But I think there was there's a certain a fear that I had for my father, for instance, that comes out in, you know, in a grotesque form in like a Freddy Krueger, who is like the ultimate patriarchal, nefarious character, you know, who is dangerous and takes delight in sort of scaring the younger. That not that my father chased me around with a glove full of knives, but it was just like, to me, he was a scary person. He was not around a great deal, and he had a sharp anger, you know, a bad temper, and I remember being quite afraid of him. I'm sure I translated some of those feelings as a small child into those kinds of characters. And a lot of my films have to do with sons facing, for instance, in Shocker, you know, facing a father who was a killer and who says basically it could be the same thing. So, you know, I don't think they would be anywhere nearly as strong as they have been if they were not in some way reflecting issues that were, you know, from deep inside myself.
Speaking of Freddy Krueger, do you remember how you came up with that image of a glove full of knives?
It was a pretty methodical sort of intellectual process. I mean, I was trying to work off of primal and ancient to sort of atavistic images and themes, you know, since I figured I was dealing basically with dreams, which were some sort of primal theater, you know, some sort of brain theater, if you will, brain cinema. I was trying to go back to the very beginnings of everything. So, you know, it was the father figure, and it was the weapon was, you know, what I thought was the epitome of human ability was the hand, you know, the human hand, which is so remarkable and so far advanced from any other animals. And going back beyond that, the primal threat that I, you know, surmised must have faced primitive man was, first of all, edged and pointed weapons of tooth and fang and claw and talon, and just put that onto the, attached that to the to that extraordinary instrument of both good and evil of the human hand.
Your last couple of horror films, Scream and Scream 2, have been so successful. Do you want to use that success to keep making more horror films, or would you like to get away from the genre and do only other things now, or mix it up?
Very much like to mix it up. I mean, I feel like, you know, I've had really an interesting career in that genre, partially from choice, partially from the fact that it was very difficult to get work outside. With the two Screams, I've had a tremendous amount of feedback now from studios and from producers saying, you know, we can see you can do just about anything because there is comedy in there and there's real relationships and really great performances. So we're developing other projects that are, you know, out of the genre. I would like to do Scream 3 because, first of all, it was a great challenge doing a sequel that has done as well as the first one. That rarely is done.
Yes, even your characters know how hard it is to make a good sequel.
Yeah, and it really is. And you know, it's now virtually at the same mark that the first one was at. And no, I can't think of anybody that's done three in a row really, really well. So that's a great challenge. After that, I wouldn't mind saying goodbye forever to horror if I could. I think that would be my choice, and just to go on into other sorts of films.
Thank you so much for talking with us. I should let you get back to work.
Okay, Terry.
Okay, let's get down to business. The way I see it, someone's out to make a sequel. You know, cash in on all the movie murder hoopla. So it's our job to observe the rules of the sequel. Number one, the body count is always bigger. Number two, the death scenes are always much more elaborate. More blood, more gore. Carnage, candy. Your core audience just expects it. And number three, if you want your sequel to become a franchise, never, ever...
How do we find the killer, Randy? That's what I want to know.
Oh, let's look at the suspects. There's Derek, the obvious boyfriend. Hello, Billy Loomis. The guy's pre-madness, pity me, surface wound conveniently missed every major vein and artery.
So you think it's Derek?
Not so fast. Let's assume the killer, or Urs, has a half a brain. He's not a Nick at Night rerun type of guy. He wants to break some new ground. Right?
Right.
So forget the boyfriend. It's tired. Who else do we got?
There's...
Mickey, the freaky Tarantino film student. But if he's a suspect, so am I. So let's move on.
Well, let's not move on. Maybe you are a suspect.
Well, if I'm a suspect, you're a suspect.
You have a point. Okay, let's move on.
A scene from Scream 2, which has just come out on video. Our interview with Wes Craven was recorded last winter. He's now working on Hollyweird, a new TV show premiering this fall on Fox, and he's directing the film 50 Violins, starring Madonna.